This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Remember the bad old days when a few European countries divided the world among themselves? They hauled in wealth from their colonies. Today, most of us are colonized, whether we know it or not, by invisible nations of capital, and they're always working to divert wealth to the few, even during disaster. It's all in a new book by Marjorie Kelly, Wealth Supremacy: How the Extractive Economy and the Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crises. Kelly is an award-winning writer with a master's in journalism, currently distinguished senior fellow at the Democracy Collaborative. She was co-founder and president of Business Ethics magazine. From New England, Marjorie Kelly, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yes, Alex, thanks for having me.
In recent news, after a public outcry, massive Saudi Arabian land holdings in Arizona just lost ownership of all the water. You open your new book talking about the water crisis. What can that teach us?
It's scary what's happening with water, Alex, and it's a prime example of how big capital is really devouring everything and looking always for new, quote, unquote, assets to acquire. So big capital, including hedge funds, is out there in Colorado, in California, buying up water rights. Fortune magazine said a number of years ago that water in the 21st century will be what oil was in the 20th century, which is the scarce resource that determines the wealth of nations. And the UN says that by mid-century, half the world's population will suffer shortages of scarce water. Now, you and me and your listeners probably look at that and think that's a humanitarian crisis. You know, water is a public good. We need to protect it. Well, big capital looks at that and says that's a money-making opportunity. We want to own it. We want to control it so they can charge through the roof for it. So I start the book with this because it's an example of two paths forward. We can continue to allow capital to devour everything, or we can own and protect our economy and make it a democratic economy. And that's what I think we need to work for.
Well, forget about the Roman Empire or the British Empire. You write, quote, "Today's empires are portfolios of assets. Can we be subjects in a colonial empire and not know about it?"
Yeah, that is the reality. I mean, we do not see ourselves as colonized. I mean, even our language is colonized. I mean, we talk about how Wall Street creates wealth. Well, in fact, it extracts wealth and extracts from ordinary people, our pocketbooks, in the form of debt and rising rents and bad jobs that are, you know, corporations are pushing workers out of good jobs and switching that income to capital. Big capital is extracting from the planet. Here's a scary fact, Alex. In 2021, fossil fuel companies saw their share price increase 60%, right? So these are, you know, the wealthiest 10% who own 89% of shares in the stock market. And most of that wealth is at the very top. So we had a wealthy few making out like bandits selling fossil fuels. And we know what's happening. I mean, the skies over San Francisco have been orange with flames. New York City has seen flash flooding. So capital is extracting from the planet in order to create wealth for itself and completely disregarding the impacts on everyone else. But let me stay with that for a minute, because we tend to look at that and we think, oh, Exxon Mobil is the bad guy. The CEO of Exxon is the bad guy. And the point that I'm making with wealth supremacy is that, no, the problem is the system. The problem is the mindset that tells us no amount of wealth is ever enough, which is the first myth of the system, the myth of maximizing. And so portfolio incomes must be maximized regardless of the impact on anyone else. And this is what our pension funds are doing, what our foundations and universities are doing. So the whole thing is on autopilot, Alex, and this is, I think, why it's imperative that we wake up. And I'll just finish here by saying that systems change tells us that the soul of the regime lives in the mind of the regime. That's where it lives. It's not just the bad guys, and of course there's plenty of those. But we have to attack this idea that no amount of wealth is ever enough, this idea that our system exists to maximize returns for investors. That's the core of the problem.
So, Marjorie, if you and I went out on the street with a microphone, I wonder how many people could tell us what financialization means. What does it mean for all of us?
First thing is that financialization is a problem as big as climate change and far more invisible. Economists have warned us about it literally for decades. And what it means is there's too much financial capital in the world in too few hands. So you have this very spiky phenomenon where these mega wealthy hold this enormous number of assets. And assets grow by extraction. They extract from workers by, you know, turning full-time jobs into part-time and contingent jobs. They extract from the planet. And those assets have to grow every quarter and every year. And so here's a picture I have in the book. Let's envision two spheres. One is sitting on top of the other, right? So the lower sphere is what we call GDP, gross domestic product. This is really the flows of income and spending that we think of as our economy. It's the real economy. You have a job, you get a paycheck, you spend it. That's tracked in GDP. But there's another sphere, and that's financial assets, you know, stocks, bonds, all kinds of debt, and so on. So that sphere, when I was a kid, used to be roughly equal to GDP. So assets and GDP were equal. Today, financial assets are five times GDP, and yet they're built to grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. And the economy is built to grow them and to do nothing else. So that's the problem with financialization. I mean, a system built on wealth supremacy inevitably heads toward financialization. So you have too much financial wealth extracting from the rest of us. And yet the myths of the system, you know, that, well, stock market creates wealth, you know, these myths keep us from seeing what's going on.
And it seems whatever comes in short supply or something you need for life, even a drug that people need to stay alive, it's just a market opportunity. They drag out more wealth from desperate, subjugated people. If it's food that you need or heat for the winter or AC for the heat waves, it's all a big chance to make even more money. And they do. What did you think of Naomi Klein's book, Disaster Capitalism?
Well, I think she named a phenomenon really quite well, which is that the system of big capital is quite happy to profit from whatever is going on, right? If it's disaster, they'll go out and profit from that. You know, if it's fossil fuel burning, they'll go out and profit from that. It's really, the system is formally indifferent to its impacts on the real world. And let me just say a minute here how it is formally indifferent. There's a principle in financial and corporate accounting called materiality. Now, what is material to ordinary people like me and like our listeners? Material means it's real. You know, it's like a rock. You kick it, it's going to hurt your toe or it's going to move. That's what materiality means. But in the upside-down Alice in Wonderland world of financial accounting, materiality means what's real for investors. So if it affects investors, it's material, and you have to report on it. You know, for example, we had Elizabeth Holmes apparently lied to her investors and ended up in prison for that. She failed to disclose her product didn't work. very well. So that was considered material, and she didn't disclose it, and that was illegal. But will your product harm the planet? Will it damage workers? Will it extract from the society? None of that is considered material unless it impacts capital. So it's this tautology of capital bias. The only thing that matters is gains to capital, and this other stuff matters only to the extent that capital will be affected. So it's this strange, insular world, Alex, that it really sees only financial gains as real and everything else is not.
Well, in old world parlance, we used to talk about the proletariat of the common people. Those are the workers, the lower class or something like that. But in your book, you talk about the precariat, and I think that's a good term. Could you tell us about it?
I emphasize how we lack the correct metrics to allow us to see what's actually going on in our economy. I talked about financial assets are 5 times GDP. We don't have that metric out there. Another metric we don't have is measuring the precariat or the insecure workforce. And this includes part-time, subcontract, gig workers, self-employed, temp agency. All of these are called contingent, or I would say it's the throwaway workforce. And this is now 40% of all workers. The federal government did a count many years ago and only did it once and hasn't done it again. So what we're talking about unemployment. Look how low unemployment is. But we're not talking about how bad the jobs are, how insecure these jobs are. So we completely lack understanding of how precarious labor is for most people. Meanwhile, what do we know about financial assets? Well, by minute we track each stock, each bond, how it moved constantly. But labor, no doing. We have so little information. We don't really know what's going on.
I can think of 3 times in American history when Democratic politicians attempted to rein in wealth and ownership. You've got the trust busting of Theodore Roosevelt, then the New Deal during the 1930s Depression, and in 1941 to gear up for World War II. There really hasn't been much intervention other than that. Well, maybe to bail out major banks and institutions when they fail. Can Western democracies reform the financial ecosystem?
I think that's the question, isn't it? I think, first of all, we need to see that it's a problem. And this is how we've been hoodwinked, or I think a better way to say it is we've been put to sleep by the lingo of the system. And I don't mean to sound like a conspiracy theorist here. I think it's I call it capital bias, this bias through institutions and practices that favors capital. I call it wealth supremacy. I think it's really a form of blindness in the same way that racial bias, I think, was largely unconscious. I think male bias was largely unconscious. It's a way of seeing the world. You see the world through a certain lens, and you just aren't aware that other people see it differently. So we have to see what's going on. That's the first thing. We have to talk to each other about it. We have to recognize the financial extraction is an enormous problem and is at the root of so many crises that we face. I mean, that's the first thing before we jump to solutions. We need broad awareness. And then there are solutions. Elizabeth Warren has a bill that would rein in private equity, which is, I call, the apex predator these days. Worker ownership. There are ways to expand worker ownership. There's also a bill out there to begin shifting capital toward funds that will buy companies and convert them to worker ownership, which is a proven model. So, yes, when you say, can we reform it, I like to separate that into 2 questions. And one is it feasible that we could have a system that's designed for all of us and not just for the few? And yes, it is feasible. The methods and models we need are here and they work. That we have proof of concept. Now, can we get from here to there? That's the question, and that's where I see that we're at a pre-awareness phase. We're not aware that capital bias and wealth supremacy is the nature of a lot of the problems we face. And I think once we begin to see that, we can coalesce around solutions.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Marjorie Keller, author of Wealth Supremacy, How the Extractive Economy and the Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crises. And speaking of today's crises, do you see a link between this wealth supremacy and the climate change that so many of our listeners are deeply worried about?
Absolutely. Climate change is a physical reality that is the result of how our system functions. But companies and all of us, the reason that we're burning fossil fuels is because this is a way that companies can maximize their profits and their share price. I mean, why is Exxon deluding us or pretending to be going green when it's not really? Because it's beholden to shareholders. The shareholders alone, financial interests alone, have a seat on the board. Workers don't have a seat on the board. The community doesn't have a seat on the board. The company defines its purpose as maximizing returns to shareholders. And that's not just Exxon. That's what the business schools teach. That's what is built into the design of corporate governance. And so we have this whole system that says serving shareholders matters. Nothing else really matters. And one of the effects of that is you have fossil fuel companies that refuse to change their ways, even though it's clear to them and everyone else that the world is being massively damaged. So, yes, climate change is one of the big results of a system designed to serve capital and nothing else.
And surely one of the secrets to capitalist control is secrecy itself. The release of the Panama Papers showed an extensive web of hidden big money held behind multiple corporate veils around the world. Banks work in secrecy. The stock market does. So does crypto. We sure need a lot of sunlight if we're going to democratize the economy.
We do. We do. We need a lot of sunlight. We need, for example, well, we need to know where the assets are, and people need to pay their taxes. I mean, that's pretty basic, and that's not being done. We need to understand how financial assets are completely overblown in relation to the real economy. We need transparency of that, and I think that we need transparency in our minds of how biased the rules of capitalism are, how corporate governance is biased toward capital. Even the income statement is biased, and this is a basic tool of every company. You know, it says gains to capital are called profit, and that's good, and drive it up, and gains to workers are called expense, and that's bad, and drive it down. You know, so you need to pay capital as much as possible and workers as little as possible. That's built into the income statement. And you know, that drive to minimize income to labor, that's a lot of what has created the right-wing reaction. These you know, a disaffected white working class is looking for culprits and solutions and not recognizing that capital is the culprit. And so, you know, we're even losing our democracy because of wealth supremacy.
Well, I think another side to what you just said, I mean, monarchies and other institutions were designed not to change, and religions are definitely designed not to change. And despite the democratic veneer, our current civilization is fighting change. People want to go back to the good old days, which were not all that good if you were black, an immigrant, a woman, or gay. Not that great. But we imagine it was, and I think that's part of the problem. Why can we imagine a better past and yet not a better future?
That's a really key question. Someone said that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is the end of capitalism. So there tends to be a fatalism about capitalism that we can't change it. It's the only system that's possible. Socialism and communism are horrible. And by the way, we have this idea that our choices are binary. We have either socialism or capitalism, we don't recognize. We can invent something new. Yeah, so I think it's hard for people to imagine a different kind of economy. And I spend about half of my book, Wealth Supremacy, showing how it can be different. And this is the work I've been doing, Alex, for 30 years, working for worker ownership. And our organization, the Democracy Collaborative, is working for what we call community wealth building, which is at the city level. And we're doing work in Amsterdam and Chicago, and Preston, England has had a lot of success with this. You know, mayors and economic development people at the local level know their communities are in trouble, and they're looking for alternatives. And so the next system is starting to arise at the local level, and this is what a lot of our work is, trying to help people envision a different kind of economy and seeing it take shape at the local level.
I know in Europe there are major corporations that have workers with seats on the board of directors. I see very little of that in America. Do you think workers should run their own corporations?
Well, I think workers should certainly have a stake in the wealth that they help to create. And I think that they should have a voice. And we know that companies run better when workers have a voice and when they have a share in the gains. There are already 6,000 substantially worker-owned companies in this nation, including Recology in the Bay Area, which is a billion-dollar company. It's 100% owned by its workers. Waste hauling and recycling and composting. Its mission is a world without waste. And garbage truck drivers make $100,000 because when you're not owned by investors and you're not skimming off so much for them, there's more to go around for workers. So worker-owned companies are feasible and they're practical and in many ways are superior to investor-owned companies. So, yeah, I think that that is a model that we need in a democratic economy. It's highly practical.
We talk about, well, let's get everybody involved together and we'll all make joint decisions. But I have to say, earlier in life, I was part of a food co-op. And it ended up just a couple of people were doing all the work and it folded, and then a private bulk food business rose in its place. The land communes of the late 70s had problems, and often they were subdivided later into private properties. It's hard, and California went through this several times. What makes you think participatory social ownership can work?
You're right. It is hard. And I think part of it is that we have a lot of delusions about the nature of democracy in the economy. We think everyone should be equal. We think decision-making should be flat, and there should be no leaders. And that simply isn't true. That isn't how it works. I mean, you and I don't vote on which streets are paved in our cities, right? Democracy is about far more than just everyone being equal and having a vote on everything. There's decision-making patterns that function. So what I'll say is that there's a whole community of experts in worker ownership who know how to create worker voice and participation without going down the diluted route of everybody voting on everything or pretending that leaders don't matter, because leaders do matter. Yes, it can work, and we have a lot of learning to do, Alex. We have a lot of misconceptions about how to create a democratic economy.
I just interviewed Carly Fabian of the NGO Public Citizen. They discovered the largest insurance companies publicly promised to get out of coal, but the fine print lets them keep insuring America's biggest and dirtiest coal companies. It's loophole ethics, and there are no police in that space. Is there a third-party assessment of corporate ethics and reality? Who can we trust?
Yeah, these are good questions. I don't think a third-party assessing ethics is the way it's going to be. And here's a lesson from democracy that I think we do need, and that is people need to protect their own interests, right? People need to have voice. You know, we need workers on boards or worker representatives on boards. We need public interest representatives on boards. There are some companies that have put representatives of nature on their governing board. We can devise ways to govern companies and investments that consider the public good. There are models out there of how to do this. So we can do it. I think it needs to be inside these entities, and of course it also needs to be outside. For example, Elizabeth Warren has floated a bill that says companies with over $1 billion in revenue needed a federal charter as opposed to a state charter, which they all have now. And within that, they would have fiduciary obligations to the public good. And 40% of board seats would be reserved for workers. It's an example of a model of how, you know, companies need to evolve. Investing needs to evolve. Working only to benefit capital is primitive and archaic. And we do need to evolve. And we need to get smart about how to do it. And there are a lot of people who have figured it out. I've seen that as a journalist over 30 years. There's so much that's been figured out.
Well, could you give us a couple of examples of successful tools that can make work and life a better place?
Sure. I mean, certainly we need more unions. I mean, if workers want to join a union, they should be able to join it. It should be as easy as joining a mutual fund, right? Nobody fights you if you want to join a mutual fund. That's basic. We also do need, you know, worker ownership. And as I said, there's 6,000 of these companies out there, and they're working, and many are B corporations, which means they have a public benefit designed into them. So those are some of the mechanisms, and impact investing is another mechanism, and we can all do that now. Those of us who are fortunate to have a little bit in assets can begin to say, how can I use my assets to have beneficial social and ecological impact? And there are a growing number of funds that are focusing on this. So we can begin this transformation.
In many countries, from Europe to Australia and America, it seems like we're losing things. We're losing democracy. We're losing public access to good health care, the environment. Should we fight back? What kind of activism is acceptable given the stakes?
I think, first of all, we need to recognize that we're at a turning point with our civilization, and in particular with our economy. We cannot go on with an economy designed to create maximum wealth for the few. That is not going to be sustainable. It's not sustainable now, and it will not be a way to live well on this planet for millennia to come. So we're at a turning point where a way of organizing civilization is reaching its end, and there's a lot of panic and misunderstanding. As you said, people want to go back to the good old days. But I think those of us who understand that system change is what we need to talk to each other. We need to read. I really encourage people, you know, to read my book, Wealth Supremacy. I've made it very readable. I make a dollar a book, by the way, so this is my get-rich-quick scheme, right? But read other things in this area. You know, get together, talk with each other. Very much like, I think, second wave feminism in the 1970s, we have to talk to each other. We have to get together and begin to figure out, what does system change look like? How can we begin to get there? I think that's what we urgently need to do.
We have been speaking with Marjorie Kellery, author of the new book, Wealth Supremacy, How the Extractive Economy and the Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crisis. You can get links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org and check out marjoriekelly.org. And I'll point out Marjorie is spelled with an I-E instead of a Y at the end, marjoriekelly.org. Marjorie, thank you for being a light in a dark place and talking with us today.
Alex, thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.